Mr. Bartlett, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the board.
You may proceed.
Thank you, sir. My name is Peter Bartlett. I am the attorney on this post-conviction matter for Cody J. Khan. Briefly, by way of procedural background, on January 27, 2012, the District Court for Douglas County, Nebraska imposed a sentence on Mr. Khan of 20 to 35 years, awarding him 574 days credit for attempted assault on a police officer second degree and the habitual criminal enhancement. Mr. Khan thereafter instructed trial counsel to file a direct appeal of the court's sentence. Counsel did not file that appeal. On May 28, 2013, Mr. Khan, acting pro se, filed a verified motion for post-conviction relief, seeking the reinstatement of his right to direct appeal. The state followed suit in February of 2014 by filing a motion to dismiss, asserting its affirmative defense pursuant to 29-3001, number 4, the statute of limitations provision. Mr. Khan then replied in June of 2017 with a formal objection. The district court, who had imposed sentence, held hearing on the matter in June of 2017, sustained the state's motion. Mr. Khan is in front of you today based on a presumption that he has that this court removed his case from the Court of Appeals in order to evaluate State versus Higgins' application of equitable tolling. Now, that may not be the court's intention, but that's his belief, and that's 291 Nebraska 443. In that particular matter, this court asked a question within the post-conviction context, and that question was twofold. Number one, does equitable tolling apply to post-conviction matters? And number two, if it does, under what circumstances would it apply?
Under what circumstances has this court applied the doctrine of equitable tolling historically?
In the post-conviction context, to my knowledge,
in the general context.
Well,
because it's limited there, is it not?
Correct. And if I may answer slightly indirectly, the concept here would be that equitable tolling would apply if it's triggered by an action that is apart from an action taken by a defendant, a criminal defendant. This court has acknowledged many times that post-conviction proceedings are there as a prophylactic measure or a secondary measure to direct appeals, that they are civil in nature because there is a presumption that the criminal process, once it is finished, has been completed in a successful and proper manner. In this particular process, the argument would be that because Mr. Khan made specific instructions to trial counsel to file a direct appeal, something he has a right to do, and further, counsel has a duty to process that request, that equitable tolling should apply because it's a unique circumstance where counsel failed to follow through on an instruction of the defendant that counsel had an obligation to do.
So historically, isn't it true that we've applied, or this court has applied, the doctrine of equitable tolling only where the thing that prevented the timely filing of the action was either conduct of a court or conduct of a governmental entity?
Well,
do we have that circumstance here?
Well, Judge, the circumstance isn't quite the same here, but under 29-3001, number 4, there's a list of factors that the court can rely upon. Specifically, subsection D talks about actions, I'm sorry, subsection C talks about actions that are impediments created by the state of Nebraska. We're asking this court, and the belief that Mr. Khan has is that this court remove this case to address this issue, which is his counsel, trial counsel, was retained counsel. He unequivocally instructed that counsel to perform a duty for him that is reasonable and within his right. Counsel failed to act on that duty with no explanation, and that failure prejudiced Mr. Khan. So this is above and apart from the factors that are delineated in the statute. And the suggestion that he's making, if this court acknowledge equitable tolling does apply within this context, and apply it to his circumstances because they are specifically unique. This is not a Huggins case. This is not a Goings case. This is a case where the litigant played no role in the fact that his case is procedurally barred under the statute. That's what the district court found.
And
that first problem.
And I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, please.
You're not suggesting that the actions of appointed counsel are somehow state actions for purposes of subparagraph C?
Well, we could talk about that, but Mr. Kahn did not have court-appointed counsel. He did not have state-sponsored counsel. He retained his own counsel.
Thank you.
So to the extent that that would apply, and that is an argument that I would have raised had that been the factual predicate here, but it is not.
Doesn't the statute build in the kind of safety valve mechanisms that you're arguing equitable tolling should provide? I mean, Section B has a discovery provision. Section C talks about a date on which state action impediment is removed. Why do we need to recognize equitable tolling when the statute seems to build in the type of circumstances you're talking about?
Well, the statute doesn't contemplate a situation where an attorney fails to perform his duty, period. The statute is talking about a set of circumstances that we all acknowledge, direct appeal, final order, subsection A, factual predicates, which are discovered after the fact, subsection B, state action or a change in the law, subsection C, or, state action, subsection C, a change in the law, subsection D. And that's what this court went through most recently in Goings. But we have a situation here that's different than those cases. Those cases are both post-mandate cases where the issue of equitable tolling came up. This case is a case where a defendant never was afforded the opportunity to have a mandate, wasn't afforded an opportunity to appeal. This is a unique circumstance, and that's why...
Excuse me to interrupt, but how unique is this, where we have a defendant for which there was no appeal?
Well,
is that not commonplace?
Statistically, I can't speak to what percentage of cases this court hears that fall into that category, but I can say that a general review of this court's jurisprudence on post-conviction does not suggest that many of those cases come to you except after a full direct appeal process and then a subsequent verified pleading. And this is a particular case where the defendant pro se, in effect, was forced to use the verified post-conviction process to remedy an error of trial counsel. You know, think about it like this. What if Mr. Kahn had said to trial counsel, please appeal my case, and trial counsel said to him, I did it. I put it on file. And Mr. Kahn repeatedly checked in with his attorney every month, every couple months, what's the status of my appeal? And the attorney said, it's pending. Court will rule on it. I'll let you know.
But wouldn't subsection B provide for that, the date on which the factual predicate of the constitutional claim or claims alleged could have been discovered? If Mr. Kahn's exercising diligence and his trial counsel is not telling him that, he's protected by subsection B, is he not?
Well, we didn't have the opportunity to raise that issue because the district court denied us an evidentiary hearing, at which time we could have raised that issue. And Mr. Kahn's, the evidence in this record, the only verified evidence with respect to notice of counsel and counsel's failure to act comes from Mr. Kahn's verified pleading, which is in the transcript.
Couldn't you have raised the issue at the hearing on the state's motion to dismiss when the very question before the court was this post-conviction motion timely filed? Isn't that the time you would have raised an argument under subparagraph B?
Well,
if you had one?
The argument was raised within the context of the transcript. You'll see a document called Defendant's Objection to Plaintiff's Motion to Dismiss. That's file stamp June 12, 2017. On page 3 of that document, there's a specific subsection that deals with subsection D and talks about the eligibility that Mr. Kahn has to litigate this matter under the different provisions of 29-3001-4.
Thank you.
So we disagree with the district court's ruling, and the district court's ruling, we feel, was a very strict application of the statute. And I acknowledge in the court's jurisprudence on this point, specifically Goings, the court has said this is a statutory construction issue, and we're going to read it very clearly. However, the counterpoint to that is the court has also opened the door in Huggins and said we may apply this under certain circumstances. And this is, I think, that circumstance, because the defendant, Kahn, was essentially denied any ability to seek further relief, whether it's through direct appeal or post-conviction action, as a result of his trial counsel failing to perform his duty. So what has happened here is we're in a different context where the defendant's denial of the ability to proceed in court wasn't due to the defendant's negligence or failure to act or failure to pursue a claim. It was due to trial counsel's failure, and that failure deprived the defendant of the ability to proceed forward.
Isn't it implicit in that argument that the defendant, once he makes the request, has no obligation to follow up to assure that it's carried out. He can just sit back and wait for a year to expire, even though if he checked at the courthouse, he'd find there was no appeal filed.
Well, I don't know that that goes hand in glove with the argument. I think what I'm suggesting is that the untimeliness of the defendant's post-conviction pleading was a product of counsel's act. The defendant,
well,
I don't think would...
Well, wasn't there 11 months that he could have discovered no appeal had been filed?
Because we didn't have an evidentiary hearing, we were not able to present evidence to the district court to explain to the court what happened during that period of time. So, as I said with the example earlier, we did the record of this case that the district court ruled without any further evidence is that the court did not know what the basis for the delay was, simply that there was a delay.
I think in Huggins maybe we were less assertive than you may have characterized in that equitable solely could be arguable. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. And here on behalf of Mr. Kahn, the argument is that this court should extend that to this particular case under these circumstances. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ralph, good morning to you.
Let's grab some water real quick. May it please the court, my name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. Primary issue on appeal is whether the district court erred in denying Mr. Kahn's post-conviction motion as time barred. As I set forth in my brief, we see no error here. The record shows that Kahn filed his post-conviction motion more than 1 year after his judgment became final.
What about the suggestion that Mr. Bartling just made that there is some explanation of as to things that happened during the 11 months between the alleged request or order to his defense counsel and the time that time ran?
Well, I guess two responses. One is he should have included that as far as, you know, detailed allegations regarding why equitable tolling should apply. You know, even assuming that, you know, this court were generally amenable to that doctrine being applied in post-conviction, you still have to, based on Huggins, relying on federal courts, explain why you pursued or how you pursued your rights diligently, as well as what extraordinary circumstance stood in your way. Trial counsel failing to file an appeal does not strike me as an extraordinary circumstance, and there's nothing in his motion or in his argument explaining how or why he could not file, as Your Honor pointed out, or check with the court within that 11-month period. Second response, I guess, was...
So to summarize, your first argument is it should have been alleged fully in the motion, and it wasn't.
Yes, or at least in the objection and the argument to the court, not just a bare assertion that, hey, he did everything he could to file timely.
Have we ordered up hearings where there seems to be a debate as to whether or not the defendant actually asked for an appeal?
I'm not sure on that, but my second response, I guess, was sort of to that assertion, is that, yes, he asserted equitable tolling, but if we're going to consider what he said in his objection and argument as his allegations, he also included an affidavit from Mr. Bartling explaining that he talked with trial counsel, and trial counsel told the defendant, when asked, that your agreement does not include appeal proceedings, it was just for trial work, and I will not be filing an appeal. So, If we're you know, accepting his allegations as true at this point, seems like trial counsel was pretty forthright with him about, you know, our agreement is just for trial work, not appellate work. So our main position, I think, and I guess it's not being argued as much here on oral argument, is that the year ran from subsection A, the date the judgment became final. In our view, that was February 27th, 2012, which is 30 days after. The expiration of it is the 30-day period having expired for the ability to appeal the January 27th order. So he had a year from February 27th to file his post-conviction motion. He did not. The 90 days is not included, as I explained in my brief. We also don't see any relevance for the appointment of counsel as to the timeliness issue. And again, equitable tolling, I didn't really research the historical application in Nebraska, but our position was, or my thinking at least, was that this court would do at worst what it did in Huggins, which is, okay, fine, assume it applies generally. You haven't alleged sufficient facts to show diligence in an extraordinary circumstance, and therefore equitable tolling, even generally applicable, would not be applicable in this particular case. All that being said, unless this court has further questions, we'd ask that you affirm the judgment below, the finding that the post-conviction motion was not timely filed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Mr. Bartling, were you appointed in this matter?
Yes, sir.
Thank you for your service. We will go on then to the